Welcome to the Grateful American Radio Show, hosted by author and publisher David Bruce Smith. What did George Washington do that you might not know about? What did Abe Lincoln know that could change the way you think about the Civil War? You'll learn about all that and more on this special show designed to restore excitement in American history. Let's get started. When it comes to restoring enthusiasm in American history, David Bruce Smith's Grateful American Foundation likes to shine a spotlight on the people and organizations that are the best teachers of the topics. So today, it is our privilege to interview Richard Semiatin, an academic director of American politics at American University. He has been teaching politics and history for nearly three decades. He is also the author of Campaigns in the 21st Century, and editor of Campaigns on the Cutting Edge, which goes into a third edition this year. I'm Hope Katz-Gibbs, your co-host, here today with David Bruce Smith, founder of the Grateful American Foundation. Well, welcome to the show, Rick.
Thank you, Hope. Thank you, David, for having me today.
Well, we're thrilled we are here at David's office in Washington, D.C., and we want to begin by setting the table for what we'll be talking about today. Clearly, you're an expert in American politics, and in fact, were interviewed countless times during the 2000 election. Tell us about that experience.
It was a really quite an overwhelming experience because I would get so many phone calls in my office, it's almost as if I didn't leave there for about 2 weeks.
Wow.
But I think the most amazing part of it was I had a student who went to watch one of the Bush-Gore cases. He got online the day before, got into the case, and he got interviewed 200 times that night and was the first person interviewed by Tom Brokaw when he came out of the Supreme Court on national TV in front of 100 million Americans.
Is that right?
Yeah, it is.
What was it about him that was so interesting?
Well, I think his experience was so unique because he came here to D.C. for a semester and he just took advantage of the opportunity to see a landmark Supreme Court case which helped determine the presidential election. And he took advantage of what citizens can do in this country, which is to go online and get a seat at the Supreme Court first come, first serve.
Yeah. So, and that, of course, is the hanging Chad issue that you, and you were interviewed dozens and dozens of times as well.
Yes, I was. I was interviewed dozens and dozens of times. And I was having dreams about Chads after that. and I was glad when the period ended so that I wouldn't have those dreams anymore.
I think we were all glad when that period ended. So let's go back, speaking of history and taking advantage of the opportunities, mm-hmm. and let's go back a few centuries to the Founding Fathers, which is what the Grateful American Foundation is focused on the first 100 years. We want kids and adults to truly appreciate what it was like to be a founding father and live during that era. So when you and I talked originally, you listed five things that transcend the American Revolution to today. So those include reason, abort, retry, and fail, opportunity, you say the outs are in, and then all the world's a stage except in the United States, where it is many stages. So I'm going to throw the interview over to David to get to the bottom of these five interesting discussion points.
Okay, so before we get to those five points, I just want to ask you to frame the trends in American elections, especially since there's going to be an election next year. I'm talking about in terms of behavior.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. And let me talk a little bit about that. Since 2008, what we have found and we've seen in marketing and we see in polling, And we see this behaviorally, is that there's a yearning for closeness in relationships, that authenticity matters. But at the same time, there's also that connection with how that relates to issues and how the authenticity of the individual relates to the authenticity of the issue. So as we head into the 2016 elections, there's a lot of talk about voter anger, but that's not unusual. That's actually par for the course. But what we're seeing this time is that there's a true yearning to see that nexus and link between the authenticity of the candidate and the authenticity of what they represent. So elections are not about personalities. They're about the nexus between personalities, issues, and personal partisanship. And that's where it lies.
And how about the conduct between the candidates? Because that has affected Jefferson, Adams, all the way forward? How has that played into who the winner is, who the loser was?
Well, what we're seeing today is that the press looks very much, it's returning actually very much to its roots in the early 1800s, when it was a very partisan press. And in that era, the press were instruments of political parties and groups. And we're seeing that today again with bloggers and other sometimes unnamed individuals, and sometimes they are, and the press has become, there's now, we've seen that there's a much more partisan press that's arising that is challenging the traditional press. And so that's why we're seeing, and that's why it's feeding into a lot more of these personal characterizations that we're seeing of the candidates that are rather unfortunate.
But going back now to these five qualities that are, I guess, comprise a cycle, reason being the first one, can you talk about that?
Oh, sure. We were the first country to have a set of rules and laws to govern it. We have to remember that rules and laws and government were done pretty much at whim before the creation of our country. Our country was an experiment. And the experiment wasn't without trial and error through the process, but it was an attempt to provide certain specific rules and laws that would make our country governable, because we did not have a king, we did not have a despot, we did not have any type of tyrannical ruler. And so in the wake of the revolution, in the wake of the failure of the Articles of Confederation, there was a need for a somewhat stronger federal government. And this was the first of its kind in the world.
So let's talk about point number two, abort, retry, and fail, which is the system of lawmaking set up in the U.S. Constitution. So tell us more about that, abort, retry, and fail.
Well, of course, I will hope. Okay, abort, retry, and fail. We're talking here about the U.S. Constitution, which is our rule book, and it's how we govern our country. And one of the important aspects of that is the legislative process and the process of making laws. The system is set up to make these things fail. It's not to have them succeed. The process is set up in a way where it has to go through multiple places where it has to be approved. And so let me take you through that a little bit. First, bills can originate in either the House or Senate. Particularly in the House, most of the bills originate there. All money bills are supposed to originate there. It has to go through committees, subcommittees, back up to the committee, voted on by the full House. And if it's a majority, then it has to go to the Senate. And the Senate passes its own version. Then the two get together and they have a conference committee. And they have to agree on one version. And so what happens is that if all that gets passed, then it goes to the president, and the president can decide to sign it, or he can decide to veto it. So it's a gauntlet that our laws have to run through. And each year, only about 10% of the bills introduced become public laws. And among those, probably 80% are reauthorizations of current law.
So it's set up to be complicated.
Yep.
And why? What's the underpinning?
Well, the underpinning of it is that the laws that become the rules that govern our society should be those that are accepted by across the institutions of government. And the whole idea is to ensure that the states have their own power and that the federal government does not make too many laws. Unlike the British system, for example, which is a parliamentary system, where a piece of law is passed, and then that's it. It's a majority. It's a simple majority. Not that way here.
The next point of yours was opportunity.
Yeah, this is really very interesting, because we are a country that provides opportunity for other individuals. The whole idea of the Constitution was not to provide too many rules So in order to maximize the choices that people have, and that if there were rules to be set, that those could be set by states and localities. But the whole idea was to provide an opportunity for any individual from any background to be able to rise in society and to have that kind of chance. Now, of course, at the time the Constitution was written, this was for white males. We have to look back at state laws back then, for example, where many women were considered chattel. Or we can look back and we can see, of course, the one enormous flaw in the Constitution, that African Americans counted as 3/5 of a person. And they did not have that opportunity. But the concept of freedom that was endowed in the Constitution, and particularly in the Declaration of Independence, eventually helped lead people to see that slavery was wrong and that African Americans and other people of color also deserve that freedom that others enjoyed.
So your fourth point is that the outs are in. What does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea in the U.S. is that minorities are protected. And it wasn't meant to necessarily mean racial minorities or ethnic minorities. It just meant the minority point of view. And this comes from the fact that in the United States and in the Americas and in the colonies, the groups that came here were small entities. Most of them were religious suffragettes. Many of them were cults. And they came here to settle because they were rejected in their own country. And they could settle here and live here freely. So that really inspired the concept that the minority can be important. So, for example, in the Senate, the minorities have as much power as the majorities do. So what does that mean? Well, California is a state of 36 million people, and it has 2 senators. Vermont is a state of 700,000 people, and it has 2 senators. The Senate is set up to protect minorities. The House of Representatives is based on population, so it's based on a majoritarian principle. But the minority Senate setup is equal in power to the majority ruling house.
To paraphrase something I believe you said, all the world's a stage except in the United States, where it has many stages. Now, they were the founding fathers were a very literate and mm-hmm. literary group. Was Shakespeare prescient mm-hmm. in this concept?
Absolutely. When he was writing As You Like It, that's exactly what he was thinking about. But in the United States, I mean, politics really is a stage. And as the quote says, and all the men and women are merely players. Each has their exits and their entrances. But in the United States, we have stages in a different sense. We have the federal government stage, which is composed of a legislature, and within it are 2 stages, a House and Senate. We have a presidential stage, and we have a judicial stage as well. And below that, we have a state stage, and below that, we have a local stage. And they're all empowered. And this creates a very complicated process, unlike countries in Europe, where states, if there are states and localities, do not have that kind of power, because the power is in the central government, usually vested in the capital. In the United States, we're very different. And this was something that was very prescient of the founders. They could not have known that the U.S. would become more than a country, but it became a continent. And as such, it is a nation of countries, so to speak, all under this umbrella, all working, and the states have a great degree of independence that you don't see in the rest of the world. And so when a foreign visitor comes to the U.S., they find it difficult to understand why the states have so much power. It's because we're a diverse country. And this goes back to the previous point, the outs or ins. We're composed of minorities. We're composed of ethnic and racial diversity. We're composed of ideological diversity. We're not a homogeneous country. We're a heterogeneous country. And so I'm fond of telling my students, in the United States, we have 435 congressional districts. It's like a jigsaw puzzle where all the pieces fit together, but the colors don't match up.
So looking back, do you think the Founding Fathers would be proud of what they created, or would they have wanted to change anything if they were living today?
I would hesitate to speak for them, because I'm not sure what they would say, because they didn't speak necessarily with a unitary voice. But I think a couple of things. One is that I think obviously they wouldn't recognize necessarily what they see. But I think the one thing that would strike them that looks most similar to them at their time that they would really recognize and be proud of is the Supreme Court. Because how the Supreme Court functions is very similar to the way it did at the time the Constitution was written. The way the presidency has grown and changed would be unrecognizable to them. But I think, though, it's even more important that they would recognize the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court is the last stop on the line for individuals in society to have their rights protected. And I think that in and of itself is something key and important the founders would be very proud of.
Okay, so when you are guiding your students mm-hmm. through the art of politics or the reality mm-hmm. of politics, how do they react to it?
They love it. They love it because they want to know how things really work. They don't want to read a textbook. They want to know how things really work. So I show them. I show them. And you know what it is? We think about issues as black and white, and in fact, they're various shades of gray. That's the reality, because there's no necessarily right and wrong of each question. Usually the answer or what happens is something in between. And it's a lot more complex. And it's not the sound bites you see on television. How television covers what Congress does or what the president does is very superficial. They're playing their institutional roles. Congress is an equal partner to the president. And they're playing their roles. And members, what is their job? Their job is to represent their districts. They are elected as ambassadors from their districts. That's their job.
All right, so explain to me what you mean when you show them. Does showing them mean taking them to the Supreme Court or the archives or the Senate? Or are you showing them through collateral material?
I have about 40 to 50 guest speakers who come into my class each semester. And half of them come to our campus and half of them are downtown. So we'll meet with a couple of members of Congress, perhaps, sometimes a senator, sometimes a Supreme Court justice. But the ones who very often give the best stories and the best insight are people you've never heard of who work in the process. And you know why they do it, David? You know why? They do it because they're giving back, and they want to give back to other people. They're giving back to students. They're doing this for free. They're not getting paid for this. And so as a result of it, they're sharing with them because, in a sense, it's a way of them mentoring young people. It's a wonderful thing that they do.
So you're providing them with something that's actually very unique for a student. You're providing them with a sense of dimension. In most cases, when you go to a poli-sci class or a history class or a social whatever class, it's flat. It's from some very boring, dense textbook. So that's a big thing.
It is a big thing. You're right. It is. And what happens is the speaker will talk usually for 30 or 35 minutes, and then they take a half hour, 35 minutes worth of questions. And I have people come in who are wonderful. People have been White House speech writers. I have people come in who have been top staff people in Congress, top political consultants, and they're telling students things off the record. And no, they don't end up on Twitter or Facebook, because I will find out. But it's more than that, though. They like being trusted. And it's a wonderful 14-week experience for them. And it's a way, it's an experience in for many of them that will change their lives.
Bringing history to life. That is the goal of our foundation, and it's beautiful that you're teaching the students that.
Thank you, Hope. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Hope. Thank you, David. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure.
One more question before we let you go, though. So Campaigns on the Cutting Edge is coming out in the third edition. Tell us about that book.
The book is about how campaigns are being transformed, not only technologically, but also humanly. And this involves not only looking at how people get elected to office, but it looks at something deeper. It looks at what are the motivations behind transforming what campaigns do in terms of fundraising, getting out the vote, polling. But it also looks at things such as how the roles of minority and women are being transformed and are also changing as well.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much for being with the Grateful American Foundation tonight. We are thrilled to have had you, and we hope to have you come back again. Maybe we can talk about the election post or before or after.
I'm honored to be your guest. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Hope Katz-Gibbs, executive producer of the Grateful American Foundation, here with David Bruce Smith, the founder of the organization dedicated to restoring enthusiasm in American history for kids and adults. Tune in for more of our interviews on thegratefulamericanfoundation.com. We look forward to talking to you soon. You have been listening to the Grateful American Radio Show, hosted by author and publisher David Bruce Smith. Here's to restoring enthusiasm in history for kids and adults, too.